Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrich. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the Chinese-owned video app TikTok is hugely popular among young people, but President Trump is threatening to ban it because of security issues. We'll find out more about the app and a potential deal in the works to keep it up and running. First, Dairy Queen restaurants around Green Bay are seeing a strong and undying demand for one of their classics, the Dilly Bar. Those have been around since 1953. The makers of the Slip and Slide reported a 180% jump in sales since April. And after barely recovering from the great fitness equipment buying panic of March, outdoors equipment is hotter than ever now. Tents, grills, hiking stuff, you name it. And stores like REI are struggling to keep up. From the practical to the bizarre, certain things have been flying off the shelves and out of warehouses, and each month seems to bring a fresh demand for something different. It might be frustrating to you as a consumer to find bare shelves or out-of-stock notices. What we're buying, though, tells a story about what we're all going through collectively. Purush Papatla is the Northwestern Mutual Data Science Institute professor of marketing at UW-Milwaukee. He's also co-director of the Northwestern Mutual Data Science Institute. Purush, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Well, we've seen headlines and anecdotal evidence, Purush, since this pandemic started about product X, product Y, selling faster than hotcakes. How do we try to get a handle on what's really going on out there when it comes to what we're thinking about buying and actually buying?
That's a great question. If I was able to answer that, I would be making a lot of money. But I think there are we human beings, as we are very complex organisms. We have a lot of things that drive us, and at different times, and we are subject to a lot of influences from outside and within ourselves. So there are a lot of theories that we can bring to the table to explain why we are buying what we are at different times. So we could be buying things because we don't want to feel left out. So that's called the regret theory. So the idea is that, we could have bought something now, we didn't. A month later, we find out that it's all gone. We don't want to face that regret. That could be one thing. We could also talk about, social influences. We see friends buying things, we hear of family buying things. So we feel we should buy too. And that kind of influence has only become stronger because of all of our collective engagement with social media, right? Everything that everyone does is on social media. So we see what people are doing. We are on social media. We feel that we should do that too. And that's called herd behavior in behavioral economics. So that could be a driver. We can talk about other reasons. So you talked about the Dairy Queen sales. That's directly linked to this whole idea of nostalgia. So why do we give into nostalgia? Nostalgia is comforting. When we are facing difficulties and challenges, going back to the past when we felt much more comfortable, when we didn't have any problems that we had to deal with, is a good way to escape that. And what better way to do that than buying products that are back from those times, nostalgic. So that could be a driver.
It seems right. Like another big category I want to point you toward is, yes, some things like hand sanitizer, I get it. There's a disease, but a lot of things seem to have gone into vogue, sold quickly when people realized their lives were not going to be the same. They weren't going to be able to go out and do things. They're not going to be able to go to the gym, say, so they buy that exercise equipment. A lot of this is us all kind of scrambling to reshape our lives on short notice. Is that driving a lot of what we're seeing?
Oh, absolutely. And I think even there, we can kind of think through the psyche of us as human beings and kind of get a sense of why we are doing what we are doing. So if you talk about the sudden spurt in the sales of, say, gym equipment, right? So we keep hearing about how you're able to fight COVID-19 better if you are in better physical shape, right? That's a kind of a theory that everyone has bought into. So that kind of at least partially explains the sudden interest in fitness and exercise and gym equipment. And so with regard to things like, backyard pools and, trampolines, those are, there because we can't really do much else socially. So we need to spend our time. We need to get some way of feeling that we are outside and doing things. So that explains that. So there are so many different things that are driving the purchases of so many different types of products.
We are talking to marketing professor Purush Papatla from UW-Milwaukee, looking at our buying habits during the pandemic, why we see a series of rushes on different products, sometimes for very practical reasons, sometimes for nostalgia, as we heard, sometimes because we think that's what everybody else is doing. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is there something you rushed out to buy or rushed out to try to buy and found empty shelves where the product usually would be? If you work in retail, if you sell stuff, have you seen runs of various sorts on the products you sell? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We heard from Chris on Facebook who writes, where I work, we were hit with a massive surge of sales. We sold out of every printer, monitor, laptop, desk, and chair within the span of 2 weeks. As soon as it happened, it ended because our supply chain was hit so hard. We were out of items for months. Ink is slowly getting back in. A lot of stuff like printers, not so much. Chris says this is part of the problem of having everything made and distributed from overseas. And Chris brings up a similar point there that, all of us, or a lot of people, I should say, suddenly realized they were going to be working from home or doing schoolwork from home all at the same time and rushing out to buy up those supplies at the same time.
Oh, absolutely. I think we all have come to the conclusion that this pandemic is here to stay, at least for some time. There doesn't seem to be an end in sight to working from home. So we all obviously feel the need to be able to do our jobs and keep up with our work. And that explains all the drive to buy the office equipment, the printers and the computers and the office chairs. So there's an obvious explanation for that. And I know there's some talk that this the shift could also be permanent to some extent. If things go well with this remote work environment, a lot of us could decide to do that. And a lot of companies could maybe come to the conclusion that it's better to have employees work from home because it, in a way, it increases productivity, reduces commute times, lets you take care of things at home while also getting your job done. So there are a lot of permanent changes that we can expect as we look into the future.
I want to give a listen to a conversation we had back in April with David Rolls, founder and president of a puzzle-making company. Let's take a listen to what he had to say about the demand he was seeing early in the pandemic.
This is certainly nothing like I think anybody has ever seen before. I was told that Amazon was completely sold out of puzzles. So, it's something we've certainly never seen before.
And Purush, I wonder if there was some contagion effect there. Some people thought, oh, I'm going to be stuck at home. I'm going to get puzzles. And then they put it on social media. And then the articles start to come out of how puzzles are selling out. And that puts the idea in people's mind, oh, I should do puzzles. These things could be self-sustaining for a while, can't they?
It could be. But I think there's also a different explanation for that. I mean, it's definitely something that the social media and the social influences have contributed to. But there's also an alternative explanation that is related to the whole idea of the benefits of problem solving. That need kicks in whenever we are exposed to something that scares us. So one way to escape the pressures and the fears of a dangerous present is to immerse ourselves in problem solving, because that takes our mind off things and it also makes us feel that we are in control. So the more difficult a puzzle gets, ironically, the more relief it gives from stress, because we are so involved in getting it done that we forget the present. And once it's done, we feel really good. We feel that we are in control of our own destiny. So that, in a way, I feel that's a big explanation for why puzzles have done so well compared to some other products.
I wanted to get your thoughts about how companies respond to situations like this. They want to market their products. They want to meet demand, but at the same time, they don't want to come off as looking anyway like they're trying to capitalize or take advantage of a difficult situation. How have you seen marketers handle that that slippery slope there?
Yeah, that's a very good question, and that's a big challenge for marketers, right? Because if you really go back to the basic laws of supply and demand, as demand increases and supply really kind of stays put, you really can't ramp up capacity, you know, ad infinitum in a short time. So as demand increases and the capacity hasn't kept up, you clearly can increase prices. But if you are a brand that's here to stay, if you're a company that has a reputation that you want to protect, you really don't want to take advantage of that and increase prices for multiple reasons. One, of course, there are regulatory issues. I know you could be taken to court for price gouging. And more importantly, you don't want to hurt your brand as well for the long run, because people have long memories. Once you seem to be a brand that takes advantage of tough times and tough situations, consumers will remember that. And you know, when the tough times go away, they might just walk away from you. So you really have to be very careful in taking advantage of tough times as a brand.
We're talking with Purush Bapatla, marketing professor at UW-Milwaukee. We're talking about some of the hot items of the pandemic, things we all seemed to suddenly realize would make our lives better, more exciting, or safer, or maybe just less boring. Call in at 800-642-1234 to share your thoughts and experiences. What items have you bought or considered buying in the last few months to adjust to life during a pandemic? Have you had trouble finding some of the stuff you've wanted to buy because maybe it was sold out because everybody had the same idea at the same time? Did you buy something because of a social media post or get the idea to go hunting for something because of that? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Purush Bapatla, professor of marketing at UW-Milwaukee. We're looking at some of the big items that people suddenly started buying during the pandemic and throughout the different stages. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Is there something you've bought or tried to buy in the last few months that seemed to be a hot item? Have you gone out and gotten some exercise gear, say, or outdoors gear has been big lately? Have you found what you wanted, or was it sold out by the time you got there? Do you sell some item that suddenly got really hot at some point in the last few months? Let us know what you saw. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Purush, I know a lot of what we could see out there is anecdotal, but you sent over to us one interesting form of data: search terms, search requests online for people trying to figure out, I guess, something about these products and whether they were available. What kind of stuff did you see?
Oh, looking at search patterns is an incredible way of understanding what people are looking for and what's hot and what's not. So this is Google Search Trends. It's publicly available data. And you can go to Google and use their trends data to look up the search patterns. What I saw was interesting. For all the items that we have been hearing about, toilet tissue, paper towels, liquid soap, exercise bikes, and face masks, you see a spike in the demand. The search for these items on Google right around mid-March. And that kind of goes on through, I would say, early to mid-April, and then it starts slowing down. And is interesting is that the search patterns, you can actually break them down into patterns across different parts of the country. So there are some parts of the country that are searching more for some items than other items. So that kind of tells you what is popular or what is in demand where. So you can also break it down by region. So for example, if you look at a category like paper towels, the region of the country where there was most search for paper towels, there's no pattern to this, but Rhode Island, Arkansas, and Minnesota really topped the search for paper towels. If you come to liquid soap, Mississippi and Connecticut, Kansas and Louisiana were the top four states from where the searches were happening. And if you look at, say, toilet tissue, Montana, Alabama, New Mexico, Nevada, and Utah were topped the searches. So, I mean, there are different parts of the country that seem to be more interested in buying different types of products. That said, what is quite interesting is that this interest in exercise bikes seems to be dominating across all parts of the country throughout the last 6 months. And one more category, which is something that we should be kind of perhaps not surprised by, that seems to be really in demand in terms of search patterns, is beer. That seems to be the top search term day after day, month after month, in every region of the country over the last 6 months. It tops every other category.
Beer, huh?
Yeah.
This means something. Let's go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Don is with us in Milwaukee. Don, hi.
Hi. Yes, I wanted to make a homemade mask. And, you know, the elastic part that goes around the ears. Mm-hmm. I went to Joann Fabric, and they were completely out, completely out. And talking to one of the clerks, they've had a shortage for quite some time now because everybody's making homemade masks.
Don, thank you so much for sharing that story. My mom had a similar moment a couple months back. It turned out some local store found some scraps and was giving them away for people who were making masks for other people. Bruce, that's an interesting one because in some cases people might be making masks for themselves. I know a lot of people were making them to, you know, to donate or to share with others. So there might be some philanthropy going on in this demand for a product.
Oh, absolutely. I think that's also a big driver of the purchases, particularly in the case of things like masks and also dry food products, right? And we can also look at it from a theoretical point of view, why people are doing that. Once again, going back to this whole idea of stress and the fear of the pandemic and all the anxiety that it's causing, one good way of getting all that anxiety out and feeling that you're more in control is to be philanthropic. When you're giving things away, you're doing something to address the problem, right? So you feel good about yourself. And you also feel that in a way you are in the driver's seat because you are doing something to address the problem rather than just sitting back. So, I mean, those are the things that actually drive the increase in sales of goods and products that can be given for use by others.
Thanks, Don, for the call. We're talking to marketing professor Purush Papatla from UW-Milwaukee, talking about the stuff we've been buying during a pandemic, trying to find stuff, maybe not being able to. Marcus joins us now in Milwaukee. Marcus, hello.
Hey, Rob. So my older brother and his wife and my nieces and nephews, they couldn't find the lawn darts, jarts. And so he called me up and he borrowed the classic set from my grandparents where it actually still has the sharp points. So, I mean, There's COVID, he's like, might as well take, you know, a little extra danger on top of it.
And so that's a good Marcus, thanks for that call. That's a good nostalgic one, those lawn darts, Purush. But it points me towards something else. I think a lot of people have a similar experience, like when we couldn't find puzzles. I know some people in our friend circle dug up old ones that they didn't care about anymore and sort of shared them around. There's some sharing economy going on that might not show up, of course, in our sales numbers.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, talking about sharing economy, I mean, the sharing economy has itself taken on a life of its own even before the pandemic, right? I mean, this whole idea of Uber and Lyft and everything else like that is all part of this growing movement of the sharing economy that we can talk about for an entirely different hour. So sharing has become a big part of the economy today. And of course, that's not philanthropic sharing. That's sharing to kind of make a living off of that. But yes, sharing is here to stay. It's a big part of the economy today.
Thanks a lot for the call. Mel joins us now in North Freedom. Mel, hello.
I live in rural Wisconsin and I farm, and I've noticed a huge interest in local produce, and particularly I farm elderberries, which have antiviral characteristics or are at least touted to. And I had a ton of people reaching out to me in March and April wanting elderberries right instantly when the virus was first gaining traction, and now that the berries are actually ripe, All those buyers seem to be gone. So I really connected with what your guest said about how the demand was super high for some products in March and April, and now that has kind of waned.
Mel, interesting story. What do you think, Purush? People wanted elderberries before they were ripe, but there's a perception, a belief that they were going to, you know, be an immune system builder, but I guess that belief has gone away now that you could actually get them.
No, I think it really ties in well with what we saw in the Google search trends as well, right? So if people were searching frantically for a toilet tissue and paper towels and liquid soap in mid-March through mid-April, now it seems to have tapered off. And the one explanation, or one of the two explanations for that, is that people are feeling a little more secure and a little less threatened by the pandemic. And that kind of propagates into every other product that is bought because of the pandemic, right? Whatever people are buying, were buying because of the pandemic as a way to guard themselves against the effects of the pandemic, those things are kind of losing their sheen because people now feel that, you know, it's kind of going to go away. We don't see the effects right away. So I think despite the fact that there's so much news about the continuing effects of the pandemic, people have kind of become used to it.
Thanks a lot for that call. Time for one more quick call from Jerry in Green Bay. Jerry, hello.
Yes, I found it's extremely hard to find a small chest freezer due to the meat shortage. I finally found one after a month and a half. They can't be found.
All right, Jerry, thanks for the call. A freezer, and there was that perception that we were going to have a meat shortage, mostly that didn't seem to pan out, Purush, but you know, that in our last minute or so, that perception that there was going to be a shortage of something, maybe even fueling a shortage because we all go out and try to buy it at the same time.
Oh, absolutely. And that kind of goes back to this whole idea of social influences, right? It's kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy, right? When we see others buying, we feel we should buy. That feeds on itself because when we go to the store, what we went there to buy is gone because everyone is buying the same things. And it kind of speeds up. But over time, as people pull back from those purchases, things start reappearing and we're not buying at the same pace. So it's quite an interesting dynamic.
Thanks for that call. And Purush, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks a lot for having me. I appreciate it.
That was Purush Papatla, professor of marketing at UW-Milwaukee and co-director of the Northwestern Mutual Data Science Institute. He joined us to talk about what items and industries are seeing high sales numbers in the last few months and what that says about the moment we are in as consumers. Coming up after the news, President Trump has threatened to ban TikTok over security concerns, but a sale to Microsoft might prevent that. We'll find out what's happening with a popular video app. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, an attorney with a long history in Wisconsin Republican politics filed paperwork yesterday to get rapper Kanye West on November's ballot here in Wisconsin. We'll learn about the GOP connections to the entertainer's presidential candidacy. First, the video app TikTok has become one of the most popular social media platforms for younger people during the last year, with an estimated 100 million users in the United States. But government officials have been wary of how the Chinese-owned company is handling the private data of American users. And last week, President Trump threatened to ban the app in the U.S. altogether. That was before Microsoft stepped in and expressed its interest in buying TikTok. The president now says the company has until September 15th to arrange a sale, and he says the U.S. Treasury should get a cut of that deal. Echo Wang is a reporter covering mergers and acquisitions for Reuters. Echo, thanks a lot for joining us.
Hey, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Well, first of all, there's a pretty big generation gap, I think, on TikTok. For people who aren't familiar with it, it isn't part of their scene. Can you briefly explain what TikTok is as a social media platform?
Sure. TikTok is a short-form video sharing platform. It basically allows you to upload 15-second videos and to share with the rest of the world. I think what is really interesting with TikTok is that it's everybody is saying that it's very addictive because the platform recommends to you what they think that you're interested in.
And now we've got these security concerns, and it emerged, I think, last year already. Some Democrats and Republicans worried about the company that owns TikTok and its connection with the Chinese government. Can you talk about the origins of the security concerns about TikTok?
Yes, sure. I think it all started from last year in October, November. There was a interagency government panel. It's called CFIUS, Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States. This committee started asking questions about TikTok because they have security concerns of the data that the company handles. So that's all everything started from last year.
And we know social media companies use our data for business reasons, for economic reasons all the time. The concern here, though, is that the Chinese government might be accessing that. Is that the problem?
Yeah, I think the security, it's accurate to say that the security concern here is more about the ownership, the Chinese ownership, because TikTok is owned by Chinese companies. It's called ByteDance. Although the company has said many times that it has never really shared any data, personal user data with the Chinese government, but there's this potential risk that they may share this data with Chinese government because it is a Chinese company.
That takes us up to last week. President Trump threatened to ban TikTok here in the United States. What do we know about his threat there and his willingness to back that up?
Because CP said the interagency government panel started looking into TikTok, and they brought authority to look into companies because it was there was a transaction happened in 2017 that gave CFIUS the authority to look into the company. And the president, of course, he has an authority to look into the deal as well. And President Trump last week threatened that he would probably ban the app if the security risks that are inherent in the app cannot be mitigated after a certain period of time. Now we know that the company now has 45 days to reach an agreement with the committee before the president would make a decision.
And this committee you've mentioned, the Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States, or CFIUS, they're not a household name exactly. Do they often step out there and shut down foreign companies operating in the United States?
Actually, that's a great question. Actually, CFIUS has been here, has been around for a few years. It was first set up in 1975, and the committee has a really broad authority over foreign investment into the United States. So basically, the story about TikTok is because TikTok it was in 2016, there was a, sorry, 2017, there was a Chinese company called Musical.ly. It's a lip syncing app. And this company was acquired by another Chinese company, ByteDance. So this transaction happened. That's why CFIUS, this committee, has the authority to look into the transaction. That's how this whole TikTok story has really come about.
We're talking about President Trump's threat to shut down TikTok, the social media platform here in the United States, and a possible sale of TikTok to Microsoft. What do we know about this possible deal? A Microsoft, not known for being a hip, cool social media company, maybe buying TikTok.
Yes. We know that Microsoft is in talks with TikTok. Potentially, they would want to acquire TikTok they would want to strike a deal by end of September 15. Well, although you're right on that, Microsoft is not especially known in the entertainment or social media space, but Microsoft is a big tech company. So they have a lot of engineering support that is necessary if they were to take over TikTok, so that they can actually, for example, they can very quickly have their engineers run code audits, run security check into the codes that TikTok might bring over if there is going to be a transaction. This is gives Microsoft a lot of leeway in terms of antitrust risks. For example, Microsoft is not really known, as you said, in the entertainment and social media space. They're not very huge in that space. So that actually makes a lot of sense for them to acquire TikTok. Although I just wanted to make sure, clarify, this is not a done deal yet.
Right.
It's still under negotiation, yes.
And President Trump said if this happens, if this company ByteDance sells TikTok to Microsoft in this case, the president says the U.S. government should get a cut of the deal. Here's a listen to the president talking about that on Monday.
If you buy it, whatever the price is, that goes to whoever owns it, because I guess it's China, essentially, but more than anything else, I said a very substantial portion of that price is going to have to come into the Treasury of the United States because we're making it possible for this deal to happen. Right now, they don't have any rights unless we give it to them.
That brings up the question, is it legal, I guess, to demand a company, to threaten to shut down a company and then to demand a cut of the take if it has to be sold? That seems unusual, that, or at least from what I've seen in the past, Echo.
Yeah, that, you're absolutely right on that. It is very unusual. Actually, for a matter of fact, the CPSC committee has never before sought a cut from the proceeds of a divestiture it has ordered. So we actually spoke to a lot of legal experts on that. And the answer to your question is that the White House actually could argue that imposing a fee on ByteDance could deprive it of resources that would otherwise support Chinese government on technology initiatives that would potentially harm the United States' interests. But however, because CFIUS is a committee that its long concern is to maintain a reputation for acting apolitically, and solely just on the grounds of national security. So a lot of legal experts are telling us that this is a major departure from the historical experience of the committee. And also potentially it could face, for example, challenges under the Fifth Amendment, for example.
I wanted to ask about that, the idea of September 15th coming around without a deal. On a practical level and then on a legal level, what does it take to shut down a really popular communication platform?
That's a great question. So the 45 days is really a time that CFIUS, the committee, has given to TikTok, to Microsoft, to come up with an agreement with committee. What the companies would want to do is that by end of September 15th, they would come up with a agreement with CFIUS that is good enough to mitigate the risks. For example, how they handle the data, how they handle the codes, and how they make sure they can make sure the government is comfortable that there's no ongoing service contract between Microsoft or whoever the buyer is and the Chinese owner, which is ByteDance on that front. And also, if there is no agreement that can be reached by end of September 15, according to the president, he's going to shut down the app, which is completely different story. Because CFIUS in this matter is actually only a tool of that the government can use to look into the deal, because there are other tools that the president can also use. For example, he can use IEPA, which is like a way more dramatic matter, a dramatic tool that he can adopt against TikTok. In that matter, he can say, okay, we would shut down TikTok, then all users in America cannot use it anymore. But what we are talking about is actually from CFIUS is whether there is going to be a sale to Microsoft or not.
And what are you watching for next, Echo, as we wrap up?
I think this is like a very interesting time for reporters like me, because I've been following the dynamics that's going on in the finance space between China and the U.S. Apart from TikTok, what I covered in the past year is a gay dating app. It's called Grindr. I'm sure you've heard of it. It had a similar situation that Grindr was actually acquired by a Chinese company a few years ago, and CFIUS reopened the transaction and finally ordered a divestment of the company. So now CFIUS is owned by an American company. These are the sort of the transactions I'm following. I think CFIUS, because it has broad authority over such transaction, and it can go back to transactions that are already closed in past years. So those are the things that I'd be on the lookout for.
Echo, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob.
Echo Wang is a reporter covering mergers and acquisitions for Reuters. She talked to us today about Microsoft's interest in buying the popular short video app TikTok. President Trump has said if a deal isn't in place by September 15th, he wants to ban the platform in the U.S. over security concerns. Coming up, rapper Kanye West is one step closer to being on Wisconsin's presidential election ballot. We'll get the details from WPR's Capital Bureau Chief coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll hear from the editors of a book on the history of rock music in Milwaukee and listen to some of the city's best bands. First, entertainer Kanye West announced on Twitter last month that he would run for president of the United States. Getting on November's ballot, however, takes more than a tweet. Specifically in Wisconsin, it takes at least 2,000 signatures and 10 pledged electors, and that varies from state to state. Yesterday, Kanye West's election paperwork was filed by a longtime Wisconsin Republican staffer and lawyer for President Trump's campaign. Sean Johnson is WPR's Capital Bureau Chief and co-host of the WPR Politics Podcast. He's been following the story. Sean, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Rob.
Well, petitions were filed, signatures were turned in. Does that mean, though, at this point that Kanye West will for sure be on our presidential ballot?
It does not mean that for sure, no. I mean, there's a lot of things that could happen with these signatures. But, you know, that's the first step of the process, is that somebody physically drops off these signatures to the headquarters of the Wisconsin Elections Commission. They're supposed to have 2,000 valid signatures of Wisconsin electors. They have about a month to collect those from between July 1st and August 4th. And they have a 5 p.m. firm deadline on that final day that could prove to be important in this case, where they have to turn those in. So I guess the open questions we have now are, did they hit that 2,000 mark when, you know, you have signatures challenged, contested, which is a very real possibility? And did they hit that time deadline?
We'll get into the time drama in a minute. Let's talk about what we know about who was involved in this effort to get Kanye West on the ballot. What kind of names are we seeing here?
So one person that you know, we know about because she dropped off the signatures is Lane Ruland. And she has extensive background in Wisconsin Republican politics. She is an attorney with election law expertise. So, you know, she has worked for as a campaign treasurer for a lot of people. For example, she was recently the campaign treasurer for former Republican Governor Scott Walker. She was a deputy chief of staff for former Republican Attorney General Brad Schimmel. She's been a lawyer for the Republican Party of Wisconsin. She's been a lawyer for Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce, the state's largest business group, a big supporter of Republican campaigns. And importantly, she is currently representing Donald Trump's presidential campaign in a lawsuit against a Northwoods TV station for running an ad produced by a liberal advocacy group. So that's a case that's ongoing, where she is representing the Trump campaign in Wisconsin. And in this case, she was working on behalf of Kanye West's campaign to drop off these signatures.
In addition to the signatures, I mentioned you need to have electors, the people who would go to the Electoral Congress and vote for you should you win. What do we know about the 10 pledged Kanye West electors?
Yeah, a lot of this was first reported by the Journal Sentinel on Tuesday. And what we know is that several of these people have Republican ties. So, for example, J.M. McCoy of Wauwatosa is one of the electors. There is a J.M. McCoy from Wauwatosa who's a national committeeman for the Wisconsin Young Republicans. There is a James Smith of Stoddard, who has the same phone number and previous address as somebody who is with the La Crosse Republican Party. Virginia Pratt of Milwaukee, once considered running for state senate as a Republican. Fred Krumberger of Suamico has donated to the Republican Party. And Tanner Hiller is an Iron County supervisor who tweets in support of Trump and Republicans. So you see a pattern emerging here.
Talking to WPR Capital Bureau Chief Sean Johnson about Kanye West's efforts to get on the Wisconsin presidential ballot. Sean, what's the thinking on why there's been this groundswell of support among Republicans in Wisconsin for Kanye West's presidential campaign?
Well, I mean, you could actually just look at an interview that West did with Forbes magazine in early July. This was pretty soon after he announced that he was running for president on Twitter, where he talked kind of openly about, you know, he talks about his own desire to be president, but he is pretty open about the possibility that his candidacy could pull black voters away from Democrat Joe Biden. He's fine with that. You know, he's not a supporter of Biden. He has been a supporter of President Donald Trump. He says he's not supporting him right now. He's running for president for himself, but there are pictures all over the place, video all over the place of Kanye West wearing a Make America Great Again cap, meeting with the president, and, you know, just very recently saying that he supported President Trump.
And we've seen a lot of very close elections. It's almost a cliche now, Sean, here in Wisconsin. A candidate wouldn't have to pull a lot of votes from another candidate to potentially make a difference, right?
No, I mean, you could diagnose some of the close elections we've had as in any number of ways, right? When a race is decided by fewer than 23,000 votes, as Wisconsin's 2016 presidential race was decided by, President Trump won by fewer than 23,000. There are any number of factors you could point to and say, aha, that was the difference. But you should look also at the third party candidates who ran in that contest. I mean, you had, for example, Jill Stein, the Wisconsin Green Party candidate, received 31,000 votes in that race. That's more than Donald Trump's winning margin. You had the Libertarian candidate in that race received 106,000 votes. These are factors when the race is as close as it was in Wisconsin in 2016, or, you know, go back to 2004 or 2000 when we had especially close presidential campaigns. It does happen in Wisconsin that we have races that are that close. Polling right now suggests that that's not the state of the current race with Joe Biden out to more of a lead, but that is polling. And, you know, we have very recent elections where we've been extremely close.
Now let's get to that. We talked about a TikTok drama about the social media app. There was a TikTok drama on the clock yesterday, Sean. What's going on? Or on Tuesday, I should say.
Yeah. So you have to turn in these signatures by 5 p.m. And I mean, there have been days on this deadline when I was not there when Kanye West signatures were turned in at the Wisconsin Elections Commission. But there have been times when I have been there, and it's full of reporters. It's full of political operatives, everybody kind of watching the clock, because often you'll have some last day drama or last minute drama on will somebody or won't somebody run for an office. And you want to be there to see for yourself if they file. In this case, there was a reporter, Matt Smith of WISN TV in Milwaukee, was outside of the Wisconsin Elections Commission and took video of Lane Ruland as she was bringing those signatures to the door. So everybody's looking at Matt Smith's tweets about this event. And, you know, he tweeted that this happened just after 5 p.m., you know, and it could have been 5 o'clock and a few seconds. But, you know, based upon, I think, my experience or anybody else's experience who's been at the Elections Commission, when that 5 o'clock hour hits, they treat it as a firm deadline. And so that could be, you know, maybe the only factor we need to look at if, in fact, the Elections Commission decides that, yes, that the signatures were turned in after five. But as of right now, we don't have an official word from the Elections Commission that that's how they're viewing this.
In our last minute, Sean, who decides, when do they decide something like this?
So you have a 4:30 p.m. deadline tomorrow for somebody to challenge this petition. And then you have a 4:30 p.m. deadline Monday for a campaign to respond. The Elections Commission has already kind of just done a cursory review, found about 2,400 signatures on the Kanye West petition. But ultimately, once staff goes through it, staff will make a recommendation, and it's ultimately up to the 6-member Elections Commission to decide whether or not a candidate gets on the ballot. That commission is split evenly between Republicans and Democrats and can make some pretty interesting political drama.
Lot to watch. Sean, thanks a lot for bringing us up to date today.
All right. Thanks, Rob.
That's Sean Johnson, Wisconsin Public Radio's Capitol Bureau Chief. He joined us to share how a Republican Wisconsin lawyer helped Kanye West file to get on the state's ballot for president in November. Keep watching for the latest news on that as the deadlines and meetings go past. You can do that at WPR.org/news, or you can follow the Ideas Network Facebook page for pretty regular updates. Since the pandemic started, a lot of people have tried some new things in the kitchen or maybe gotten back into the things they used to do. I know that anecdotally from friends and family and from your calls over the last few months. And there have been some economic indicators with things like bread making supplies, yeast, flour, selling out in stores for a while there. Tomorrow on Food Friday, Judith Sears-Poisson and I will share some of our latest kitchen experiments. And we want to hear from you about what you've been cooking. You can head on over to the Ideas Network Facebook page and let us know what you've been up to. I understand there's a lot of action there already. Have you tried something entirely new to you? A different style of cooking, something fancy or baking, whatever? Have you turned to your favorite comfort foods? If so, what does comfort food mean to you and what are you making? Have you gone back to an old kitchen pastime, making preserves, bread making, whatever that might be? Have your meals gotten simpler in the last few months or more complicated? Share your answers to any or all of those questions. You can do that right now over on the Ideas Network Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Then join us tomorrow on Food Friday. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.